Alex for interviewing me earlier, and thank you for all coming. I want to sort of just kind of introduce the paper that I'm going to be giving, kind of let you know the general context in which this that I'm working on right now, and kind of detailed parts of the talk for today. So after I wrote that book on Hume, I, for reasons that I still don't understand, I ended up deciding to write that book on what is philosophy, in part because I felt that the What is Philosophy book was one of the least understood books that Deleuze and Guattari wrote. And in the process of writing that book, I came to realize that one of the core issues in that book seemed to be the theme of making sense of life and a pedagogy of concepts, as they talk about in the introduction. And one of the things that they develop in that book is that science, philosophy, and art are three different ways of sort of making sense of life. So after I finished that book, I kind of got back into rethinking the stuff I'd written on the Hume book. And one of the issues that emerged in the context of working on What is Philosophy is the importance of problems and learning for Deleuze, and in particular for kind of Deleuzian metaphysics. So that kind of led to the Lever-Hulme application, where I kind of claimed I was going to be writing a book on the metaphysics of problems as one could develop this from Deleuze's work. And I have actually written the first part of that book, which, or two books, depending on how long they allow me to write it. And the first part is on the metaphysics aspect of the title is Truth and Relevance. And so the question here is, metaphysics of problems ties in more to the relevance of situations with respect to understanding truth. The second part is more on politics. And so the second part is developing the theme of life as a problem, how that would play into political theory, and so on and so forth. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to kind of take from both parts, from the metaphysics part and from the sort of the developing political theory part. This is a work in progress, so by all means, rake me over the coals and tell me where I can improve, where you see things that could be done, etc., etc. The first part I'm going to look at the influence of Hume again on Deleuze, kind of revisit that theme and show why I think it's relevant to the bigger question of Deleuze-Humean political theory. In the second part, I'm going to look at Pierre Bourdieu's work as a way of contrasting the problematic fields concept as Deleuze develops it with the concept of social fields as Bourdieu develops it. That will bring me from the metaphysical discussion of part one into the more political discussions of part two. And then in part three, I will look at some of the histories of primitive accumulation by Alan Wood and others that have been written, and look at how Deleuzian interpretation can help clarify some of those issues about the emergence of capitalism, and where that leaves us with a sort of Deleuzo-Humean political theory or critique. It sounds like a lot, but it's really kind of tip of the iceberg stuff. I'm going to just touch on a lot of these themes, and a lot of that can be elaborated more fully as we go into the question and answer and so on and so forth. Okay, so without further ado, I'll get started. As Deleuze says on numerous occasions, philosophers have never been truly motivated by the what is X question. Rather, as Deleuze puts it, questions such as who, how much, how, where, when are better questions, questions that are integral to the process of encountering a problem that then prompts and shocks us into the effort of making sense. To expand upon what I mean, let us take the case of the jealous lover, as Deleuze does as well in his book on Proust. Proust was well aware of the pressing questions just mentioned, and the jealous narrator of The Prisoner admits that such jealous questioning, quote, always made him more open to the world of the possible than to that of real-life contingencies, end quote. He then goes on to admit that he would be well served if he could find within himself a prefect of police who reasons logically and in accordance with the probabilities of one's given situation. Such is not the case, however, for one who is jealous. For rather than confine themselves to the probability and logic of one's situation, They continually go beyond what is given to all the possibilities between here and the four corners of the universe. That last line was from Proust. Reality, our jealous narrator admits, quote, is always a mere starting point towards the unknown, on a path down which we can never travel very far. It is better not to know, to think as little as possible, not to feed jealousy on the smallest concrete detail, end quote. So any determinate detail will simply feed and intensify the jealous questioning, the effort of the jealous person to come to terms with the reality that makes sense of their jealousy. Even if the jealous lover were given a determinate, indisputable fact, let us say proof that their partner had indeed cheated with a particular person, photo left in a conspicuous spot or a texted video or something like that, just to kind of prove that your partner has cheated with so-and-so, okay? This will only intensify the questioning, right? That truth won't solve the problem, is the point that I'm making here. How did this occur? Where? When? And who else is there? If there was this person, might there be others? And who, when, and in what circumstances did these occur? And so on. With these questions, the jealous person encounters the problematic reality that makes sense of their jealousy. And that's the key idea I'm trying to introduce here, the notion of problem, problematic reality, as Deleuze is going to develop it metaphysically. So the questions can lead to this sort of problematic reality, but at the cost or the potential cost of a delirium of ceaseless questions. So there's a great film by Louis Buñuel called El, him in Spanish. And in this film, an older man marries a younger woman, and he gets increasingly jealous of her. In fact, she was formerly engaged to someone else. And that on the wedding night, he thinks she is thinking of her former boyfriend. And during the course of the film, he gets increasingly delirious, right? He slips into madness by the end of the film. So that's a good example of, kind of in the same sense as for Proust, where you can see this sort of jealousy just taking over and going to the four corners of the universe, as Proust might have said. So we find in Hume a similar awareness of our tendency to move beyond what is given and going to the four corners of the universe, to follow the imagination to an infinity of possibilities. This is where delirium enters the scene for Hume. This occurs in relation to Hume's principles of association, Hume 101, right, causality, contiguity, resemblance, right, principles which naturally lead us to connect one impression and idea with another. Namely, these are the principles of resemblance, contiguity, and causation. Over time and through repetition, these principles solidify into habit and custom, the result being that we have a more lively expectation and association between some ideas than others. The idea of a mountain and being covered with snow will have more numerous associations and hence result in a more strongly held belief about reality than the idea of a mountain being made of gold. And thus this will affect, in turn, what we take to likely be true or false about reality. In cases of delirium and madness, however, the role that habit and custom play in determining what we are likely to believe comes to be undermined. As Hume describes such a scenario, and this is the first quote on the handout, though if you don't have a handout, it's the quote up there. This is Hume. A lively imagination very often degenerates into madness or folly and bears it a great resemblance in its operations. So they influence the judgment after the same manner and produce belief from the very same principles. When the imagination, from any extraordinary ferment of the blood and spirits, acquires such a vivacity as disorders all its powers and faculties, there is no means of distinguishing betwixt truth and falsehood. But every loose fiction or idea, having the same influence as the impressions of the memory or the conclusions of the judgment, is received on the same footing and operates with equal force on the passions. A present impression and a customary transition are no longer necessary to enliven our ideas. Every chimera of the brain is as vivid and intense as any of those inferences which we formerly dignified with the name of conclusion concerning matters of fact, and sometimes as the present impression of the senses. So in the case of the Buñuel film that I was mentioning, at one point early in the film, the husband's walking down the steps and he hears someone in a neighboring apartment laughing. And he thinks they're laughing at him. Okay, they're actually laughing, but he interprets it as they're laughing at him. By the end of the movie, in the church, and that plays a whole subplot as well in the film, he actually sees people laughing when they're not laughing at all. Right, so we have a more complete slip into delirium at this point in time, where ideas and thoughts become mistaken for impressions. Right, that's, I think, the aspect that Hume is talking about here, and that filmic example from Buñuel makes this point as well. In this passage, Hume is reiterating a point he made in the first pages of his treatise, namely, the rather obvious point, obvious for Hume at least, that there is a distinction to be made between an impression and an idea. So the second quote, "Every one of himself," Hume claims, "will readily perceive the difference betwixt feeling and thinking, and hence between feeling one's legs break, the impression that one gets when one has broken one's leg, and having broken my leg, I know that impression, what it feels like, and thinking about the time one broke one's leg. There are, however, times when this distinction fails to hold, such as," Hume argues, "in sleep, in a fever, in madness, or in very violent emotions of soul, our ideas may approach to our impressions." End quote. So if we think of the delirium which might befall a jealous lover, their incessant questioning may well lead them to conclusions that are far beyond being matters of fact, as happened in the case of both Proust's book and in the Buñuel film. Facts justified by the probabilities that come with the principles of association, the probabilities that would be the basis for how Proust's police prefect would think. So kind of in a longer version of this, one thing you could think about here is that Hume has been appropriated by sort of a Bayesian epistemological approach with respect to belief based on probabilities. So kind of a Bayesian understanding of knowledge would be one where the probabilities kind of would say that this is something that one would more strongly believe and therefore act on than others, and so on and so forth. The point here that I'm trying to stress, and I think this is the point that Deleuze gets out of Hume as well, is that underlying this probability is the potential threat of delirium, or the problematic reality that undermines even the best attempt to try to rein it in through probabilistic reasoning. As Hume puts it, the delusional beliefs of the jealous lover can come to have the same status as those we formally dignified with the name of conclusion concerning matters of fact, namely the ones that principles of association over time would lead us to more strongly hold to. Thus, although our thinking usually follows the tried and tested patterns laid down by the principles of association and the customs and habits built upon their repetitive application, there is no guarantee that this will occur, and the infinite play of imagination and the threat of delirium is an ever-present risk associated with thinking. This is the problem Hume leaves us with, or is what one might call the problem of Hume. It is the inseparability of delirium from thinking that will be a primary focus of Deleuze's interest in Hume. Of particular importance for Deleuze will be passages such as the following, where Hume acknowledges, quote, "the liberty of the imagination to transpose and change its ideas," to which Hume adds that "the fables we meet with in poems and romances put this entirely out of question. Nature there is totally confounded, and nothing mentioned but winged horses, fiery dragons, and monstrous giants," end quote. In other words, we need only to open a poem, romance, or a Harry Potter book to realize the liberty with which the imagination can combine and change its ideas. As Deleuze takes up this passage, he sees the starting point for Hume's project as being one where, quote, "left to itself, the mind has the capacity to move from one idea to another, but it does so at random, in a delirium that runs throughout the universe, creating fire dragons, winged horses, and monstrous giants," end quote. So you can see Deleuze there both referring to Proust and Hume, right? He's basically almost paraphrasing Hume here, but the four corners of the universe is the passage that comes from Proust. So as Deleuze reads Hume, This delirium comes to be tamed or is drawn into habitual patterns by way of the principles of association, which gives rise to the sort of the Bayesian appropriation of Hume. As Deleuze states this point,
third quote,
the principles of human nature impose constant rules on this delirium, laws of passage, of transition, of inference, which are in accordance with nature itself. The important point to draw from Hume as well as Proust is that making sense of a situation involves a thinking that is inseparably related to a delirium that may well undermine the very task the thinking sets out to do. To state this point differently, if thinking sets out to think determinate thoughts, thoughts with some determinate representational or propositional content, then this thinking also involves a problematic tendency which may well undermine the very tendency toward determinate thoughts. To make sense of things thus risks invoking the problems that stop making sense. So that ends the kind of the first part where I'm kind of laying out the nature of the metaphysics of problems. So kind of just briefly recap, right? The point of the jealous lover here is that there's a kind of problematic reality that no determinate solution solves the problem once and for all, which is a theme that Deleuze will stress on numerous occasions, right? The problems are not exhausted by their solutions. The problems actually make the solutions themselves possible. They subsist in the solutions, so on and so forth. So the jealous lover is an example of where the solutions become undermined by falling into a kind of delirium of this problematic reality. So that's kind of the first part. Now I go on and I want to kind of clarify this more by comparing this with what Bourdieu does. So we can further clarify Deleuze's understanding of the nature of problems by turning to Pierre Bourdieu's work. In particular, Bourdieu uses the concept field in a way that is similar to Deleuze. Deleuze begins his final essay, Immanence, A Life, for instance, with the question, what is a transcendental field? As Bourdieu understands the concept field, it is similar to, but importantly different from, the understanding of fields among physicists. The similarity seems clear. In stating the consensus of physicists, Steven Weinberg, a physicist, claims that, quote, material particles such as photons were reduced in status to mere epiphenomena of, for example, electromagnetic fields, end quote. Similarly, one could argue that the agency of individuals could be interpreted to be a mere epiphenomena of various social fields, such as kinship structures, etc. However, this is the structuralist understanding of agency that Bourdieu is pushing against, right? For Bourdieu, his project is to be viewed as one where he being Bourdieu, wanted, so to speak, to reintroduce the agents that Lévi-Strauss and the structuralist, among others, Althusser, tended to abolish, making them into simple epiphenomena of structures. So what Bourdieu is going to do, and I'll elaborate this a little more fully in a few moments, is you will see this notion of fields as being analogous to what's going on in physics. But what Bourdieu wants to do is he doesn't want to make agency to be a mere epiphenomena in the way that photons are epiphenomena of electromagnetic fields. Because then he would fall into a sort of a structuralist understanding of agency that he doesn't want to do. On the other hand, he wants to avoid the sort of purely conscious conception of agency that he finds in phenomenology. So he's going to try and steer a middle course between those two different traditions. As Bourdieu goes on to add, social agents in archaic societies as well as in ours are not automata regulated like clocks in accordance with laws or structures which they do not understand. End quote. It is for this reason that Bourdieu adds the concept of habitus to the concept of field, in order to avoid falling back into a structuralist determinism on the one hand, and a form of conscious voluntarism or phenomenology on the other. The various intellectual alternatives one is supposed to choose between, whether this be empiricism, structuralism, or phenomenology, are for Bourdieu, quote, completely fictitious and at the same time dangerous, end quote. And it is these very alternatives, he argues, that the notion of habitus is meant to exclude, those of consciousness and unconscious, of explanation and determining causes, or by final causes. So with habitus here, we can also see, I mean, in a longer version, you could see how habitus could tie into the notion of habit and sort of the Humean conception of habit, and also the formation of habits as kind of Deleuze will understand and extend the notion from Hume. For Dieu believes that his account of, quote, the relation between habitus and field supplies us with the only rigorous way of reintroducing agents and their individual actions without falling back into the amorphous anecdotes of factual history, end quote. In other words, the habitus of an individual is neither an epiphenomena of social structures, nor is it reducible to being a phenomenological aspect of subjective experience. Rather, it is what Bourdieu describes as a, quote, feel for the game, whereby an action's agents are, quote, immediately adjusted to the imminent demands of the game, end quote. And thus their behavior can be seen as being directed towards certain ends without being consciously directed to these ends or determined by them. So in Bourdieu's book, Distinction, he goes through exhaustive detail with a bunch of examples. So one example would be if you've taken Greek in your elementary education, it's not so much the Greek that's important. It's just that there's a certain habitus or certain types of behaviors that one picks up by being with one's peers in the Greek courses and so on and so forth that ultimately leads to having distinction, social distinction among one's peers. So that's the sense of having a feel for the game. It's not something that one can consciously develop, this habitus. That's where he's kind of against the phenomenological approach. Nor is it a mere epiphenomenon. Not everyone is predetermined to acquire the habitus. But some people do and some people don't. And those who do get the distinction, those who don't, don't. Okay. So in other words, habitus is what accounts for an agent whose feel for the game results in actions that are both irreducible to the social field in which they occur, in other words, they are not predetermined by that social field, and hence to the structural rules and laws that might be used in an attempt to model such behaviors, and they are irreducible to the conscious awareness of why we are doing what we are doing when acting, and hence to a phenomenological account. So if we think of like Sartre's examples of sort of the pre-reflective cogito, right, if you're running to catch a train, you may not be conscious of the fact of why you're doing what you're doing, but if someone were to ask you, why are you running? You'll say, I'm late for the train, I'm trying to catch my train, right? So there's a kind of pre-reflective content, determinate content, that may not be in one's conscious mind at that point in time, but it's there pre-reflectively. What Bourdieu's arguing is that this habitus or feel for the game is not even a determinate pre-reflective content. It's just sort of a way of acting that is sort of imminently and automatically adjusted to the rules of the game. And those who do it well acquire distinction, those who don't, do not. Okay, so we can now, with kind of Bourdieu in mind, we can now return to the nature of problems or problematic fields to better connect with Bourdieu's work and with Deleuze's late interest in transcendental fields. As with the understanding of fields in physics, a problematic field is understood to be the condition for the possibility of the determinate, individuated entities that are manifestations or epiphenomena of their field. So, I mean, if we want to think of one of the core metaphysical projects for Deleuze, it's how can we account for identity, right? What are the conditions for identity? Rather than relying upon identity to account for identity, how can we account for identity without presupposing that which we want to explain? My argument here is that problematic fields is the metaphysical condition for determinate identity. Okay, that's why I think the metaphysics of problems is so crucial for Deleuze, and where this concept of fields is also, I think, an interesting concept, because even within science, a field, although it is a reality, is the condition for determinate distinct entities like photons and so on and so forth. Okay. Bourdieu will also adopt this understanding of field and echo the physicists when he claims that, quote, the individual, like the electron, is an emanation of the field. In particular, for Bourdieu, what a field makes possible is a species of capital, such as, quote, the knowledge of Greek or of integral calculus, end quote, which we could say is a form of social capital. So the knowledge of Greek, for instance, may place one in an advantageous social position vis-a-vis others who lack this knowledge or social capital. Field is thus, as Bourdieu defines it, a network or a configuration of objective relations between positions, such as the relations between those who do and do not have various forms of capital. So some of the examples that Bourdieu gives, if you're a red wine drinker, puts you in a different class of social distinction than if you're a beer drinker. Or maybe we can update it today. If you drink Budweiser, you're in a different class than if you drink craft beer, right? Something like that. But we have these all these sorts, which we don't consciously think about as putting one into a different level of distinction. But that's the sense of habitus that Bourdieu is about. But the point here is that each of these actions is a determinant position or behavior within the social field, right? Whether you know Greek or not, whether you've taken Greek or not. In fact, I have a friend who's, we were talking about the elite education system that's been in the UK for a long, long time. If you go to Eton, the physical institution of Eton looks very similar to the physical institution if you go to Oxford. Everything from the refectory to the courtyard of the school. And then if you end up in Parliament itself has a very similar physical structure. So in other words, so it's not just behaviors, but there's many, many different things that kind of come into this role of habit or habitus. And if you have a feel for it, you acquire levels of distinction. Whether deserved or not, that's a whole other issue, which we will get to maybe in a few minutes. But that is, I think, where Bourdieu is talking about. These are actual determinate things, roles and positions. And his book, Distinction, is filled with investigative empirical studies about these roles and positions and so on. Okay. This is where the difference between Bourdieu's understanding of field and that found in physics comes. In short, for Bourdieu, the objective relations between positions is something that is itself contested by the various social agents who bear the various species of capital made possible by the field. So we might, for instance, say, why do we need to study Greek? So you might challenge or contest the need for Greek. And over time, that's where the history comes in. Over time, the study of Greek may no longer be necessary. Other things, other roles and positions will come in to take the place in order for distinction to emerge. At least that would be what Bourdieu would argue. Fields thus have a history of contestations such that, quote, the regularities and the rules constitutive of this space of play will themselves undergo transformation, end quote. There are times, Bourdieu notes, when attempts are made to cement the relations of the social field. This occurs, Bourdieu claims, in certain pathological states of fields, such as total institutions, asylums, prisons, concentration camps, or dictatorial states, where there are attempts to institute an end to history, end quote. Or there is the attempt to create fields that are immune to being contested, immune, therefore, to historical transformation. For reasons that will become clear in a moment, problematic fields by their nature resist such pathological states, for they are the condition for the emergence of the determinate relations that total institutions attempt to freeze into place. And moreover, problematic fields are not to be confused with their solutions, with the entities and determinate states they make possible. We can now begin to see how problematic fields differ from Bourdieu's use of the concept field. For Bourdieu, if a field is a network or a configuration of objective relations between positions, with these relations being relations of forces, forces that define the limits of the field itself, there shouldn't have been an if there. A field ends, in other words, where the effects of the field cease. So in other words, for Bourdieu, a field is to be defined by the effects it produces. So knowledge of Greek, if it gives you distinction, then we could say that that field has produced that effect. If knowing Greek no longer produces the distinction, the habitus for knowing Greek doesn't have the effect it used to have. So a field is basically determined by the effects it produces, according to Bourdieu. A problematic field, by contrast, is not a network or configuration of forces. This is key. It's not a network or configuration of determinate forces. But it's a network or configurations of becomings. What Deleuze and Deleuze and Guattari will also call incorporeal transformations, or what I will call making sense. The difference here is subtle but significant. First, integral to the process of making sense is the tendency toward Humean delirium, to get to the point of the first part, toward the delirium that undermines that which makes sense. And second, there is a tendency toward the determinant, toward further determining and differentiating that which is, determining who, when, where, how many. That is, the determinant content of that which makes sense. Making sense, however, is neither delirium nor determinant. Rather, it is a problematic field, a process. Moreover, although a problematic field is the condition for the determinant which arises as solutions, problematic fields are not exhausted by these solutions and thus are not to be confused with determinate corporal solutions, hence the use of the term incorporeal. So this is where learning becomes such a key concept, I think, in Deleuze's work. If you look at difference and repetition, when they talk about, there's a famous example, at least Deleuze refers to it as a famous example, though I have yet been able to track it down. I used to think it was Kohler that he was referring to, but it wasn't in Kohler. Those are examples that Merleau-Ponty refers to, the monkey who uses the sticks to get the banana that's out of reach, and so on. This study is where monkeys are looking for food under boxes of different colors. And let's say the food is all under the boxes that are blue, but there's also green boxes, red boxes, yellow boxes, let's say. And so the question is how long, but the process of learning the rule that the food is always under the blue boxes. Now, what Deleuze argues is that at first it's random. Once the monkey has figured out there is food there, they kind of pick up the boxes at random. But then he goes on, this is key, claims that there is a paradoxical period when the errors are reduced, but they don't yet know the rule associated with the foods under the blue boxes. This paradoxical period is what I would call the problematic field, right? In other words, we've got the elements in a problematic relationship, but we don't have a solution. Okay? We don't have randomness either, right? In order to learn, one has to first construct a problematic field. If we think, for example, learning to drive in the States, we call it stick shift cars. To learn to drive a stick shift car, there's elements that need to be brought together. You've got the stick shift, the clutch, the accelerator, brake, steering wheel, impress other elements as well, whether the road is sloped or not, and so on. If one is to learn to drive a stick-shift car, one has to bring all those elements together. Okay. At one point, one won't have known yet or have acquired the skill yet, but at one point, a problematic field will have been created where there will be enough consistency to what you're doing that makes it possible to learn and acquire that skill. That's the nature of the sort of the problematic field. On the next page, after the monkey example, Deleuze gives the other famous example about learning to swim. That is also, and he also says on that page that learning is the appropriate word to use when we are confronting the objecticity of a problem or idea, to put with a capital I. And he uses objecticity because it's objectness, right? It's objectivité, right, in French. It's not an object, so it's not a known rule or determinate thing yet, but it's not nothing. Right? There's a reality here that is the problematic reality that I'm trying to get to. And I think learning is a good way to kind of think through what Deleuze is doing here. At the same time, problematic fields are not independent of the solutions they make possible, for they are only discernible with their determinate solutions. A problematic field, in short, is what is presupposed when a determinate entity comes to be or when it becomes something other, and it is an incorporeal transformation or multiplicity of such transformations, for it is irreducible to any determinate corporal entity. Determinate corporal entities are epiphenomena of problematic fields, or emanations of fields, as Bourdieu puts it. Okay. So one last example, kind of learning to kind of show how, let's say, learning to tie one's shoes. If anyone has spent time with a bunch of kindergartners who are in the process of learning to tie their shoes, the problem is fairly clear. You want to tie the laces together in a way that you can kind of easily untie the shoes, right? You don't want to tie it in a knot, which often kids will do too. But as anyone who knows, seeing kids do this, they will often come up with some pretty interesting solutions to that problem. And yet the problem, and they might go back and come up with a different solution to the same sort of problem. That's the notion that the problem doesn't go away with a particular determinate solution. Okay. It is here, however, where the difference with Bourdieu lies. For a problematic field is not to be understood as a configuration or network of objective relations between positions. Get back to your point that these positions are determinate positions that Bourdieu studies exhaustively in his book. With these positions taken to be determinate, individuated positions that are actual positions within a given field, positions that are contested and have a history. For example, do you know Greek or not? On this point, our understanding of fields is closer to the view found in physics, where fields are what make actual material particles such as electrons possible. Although these fields are real and inseparable from the particles that emanate from them, they are not composed of actual particles, nor are they to be confused with actual particles, but instead they consist of virtual particles, for example, virtual photons. And physicists will actually use the term virtual here in speaking about virtual photons that aren't actualized yet as a determinate photon. We can thus see why Deleuze will use the term virtual when discussing that which makes determinate actual entities possible. As Deleuze will say on a number of occasions, the virtual is real but not actual. For us as well, a problematic field is a network and configuration of incorporeal transformations or becomings, or is a virtual field that is real and not to be confused with a set of actual positions, nor the objective relations between actual positions that form the basis of Bourdieu's understanding of fields. So that kind of ends the sort of the nitty-gritty kind of really sort of dense part of the talk where I kind of compare and contrast Bourdieu and Deleuze to kind of lay out the sort of nature of fields. So now I want to, in this final part, tie it into kind of the main theme of politics and capital. Hopefully the first two parts will kind of come in and show and clarify what I say here in the final part. So we can now turn in the final section to some arguments concerning the nature of capitalism and markets to clarify the Deleuzian arguments regarding problematic fields. On the one hand, it may appear that the notion of a problematic field would be very much amenable to embracing laissez-faire capitalism. Friedrich Hayek, for instance, has famously argued that market forces are much more adept and able to respond to changing circumstances than politicians, whose efforts are more likely than not to create more problems than those they intend to solve. Market processes thus give rise to determinate relations and distributions of resources, but are not to be reduced to these solutions or these relations. And any attempt to predetermine market processes in accordance with a political agenda, or any attempt to model in advance the determinate ways in which the market should or will proceed, will end up making matters worse. So that's kind of my paraphrasing, summarizing what I think would be kind of a Hayekian position. The spectacular failure of the Black-Scholes equation to determine the market prices of derivatives and the role this failure played in the subsequent financial crisis of 2007 is a notable example in support of Hayek's caution. If one finds problematic fields, which are likewise not to be confused with the determinate actualities they make possible, to be functionally equivalent to market processes in Hayek's sense, then one would be inclined to claim, as Luke Boltanski and Yves Schiapello do in their book, The New Spirit of Capitalism, that Deleuze's thought offers, contrary to his own intentions, a defense of neoliberal capitalism. There is a key difference, however, between problematic fields and market processes, as Hayek understands them. Namely, for Hayek, markets operate according to mechanisms that are impersonal, meaning they are not to be confused with the determinate will or wills of individuals and groups. If I lose my job due to redundancy, or if I become impoverished due to excessive medical costs, and that's the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States, because we don't have a very good healthcare system when it comes to paying for healthcare. So the leading cause of people filing for bankruptcy is medical costs, medical bills that they cannot afford. So, common example. No blame is to be cast in those circumstances, according to Hayek, as long as these consequences are the effect of impersonal economic processes,
what others would call creative destruction, right, in market processes, where the damaging effects of such processes are, to quote Hayek, quote, not different from that of any natural calamity, a fire or a flood that destroys my house or an accident that harms my health. Hayek's move, however, presupposes that we can determinately separate the impersonal from the personal, or relatedly, that economic processes are to be determinately contained in their own politics-free zone, independent of the determinate actions, desires, and agendas of the individuals who are subject to the effects of these economic processes. It is here where a classical Republican critique of capitalism could be made, and it's just such a critique that I find implicit in a number of the existential writers, such as Nietzsche, Sartre, but also Deleuze, admittedly not an existentialist. That's, and sort of, as I was talking with Keith earlier, one of the things I'm interested in here is my early interest in philosophy was through existentialism. And one of the things I'm finding in the project as I'm developing is some interesting resonance with some of the themes that one finds among some of the classic existentialist writers, especially Sartre. One can also find the classical Republican critique of capitalism in Marx, as William Clare Roberts has argued for in his book, Marx's Inferno. To state the argument briefly, the ideal of classical republicanism was to eliminate arbitrary power. For arbitrary power, as Roberts notes, quote, has a tendency to corrupt the character of the subjective, because the practice of virtue entails a more or less predictable alignment between being good and doing good, between the actions that will perfect one as a person and those that will achieve one's ends. This alignment is disrupted if the achievement of one's ends is dependent upon the caprice of someone with the power to interfere in one's life at will, end quote. So that's a classic argument against arbitrary power, how it undermines sort of this notion of being good and doing good, the predictability that's sort of necessary in order to realize one's ends. With the rise of capitalism and the process of primitive accumulation that comes with it, increasing numbers of people have become compelled and forced to enter the market in order to attain the very conditions of their subsistence. Upon entering the market, however, one becomes subjected to economic processes that disrupt the ability to achieve one's ends, or there is no way, Roberts goes on to claim, quote, to ensure that one's labor power, or one's commodity in general, is marketable. That is precisely the problem, end quote. In other words, by being forced to market oneself, to place one's labor or one's commodity in general onto the market, for example, by placing one's skills and expertise in philosophy on the academic job market, okay, one's prospects at making a living are subject to impersonal market forces, which are often hard to determine, if not outright arbitrary. Now, we might say, well, there's decisions of administrators and so on and so forth, but often most of these decisions often cloaked in we can't afford its market laws in terms of funding and so on and so forth. So there's a kind of impersonality with respect to a lot of the effects of Marx. At least that's Robert's point as he's interpreting Marx here. The life-changing effects that may result if one fails to get a job, the ensuing poverty, etc., is not to be chalked up, on Hayek's understanding, to anything that one may seek to change through political action and agency. But it is rather to be seen in the manner of a natural calamity. And thus there is nobody to blame for the consequences that befall us. As the classical Republicans understand this, however, the result is clear. One is not free under capitalism. As Robert states it, quote, commercial society leaves us unfree because it renders us systematically irresponsible for our economic life, end quote. We are no longer responsible for the conditions of our life activity, for it is not us, but impersonal market forces that deliver the conditions of our life activity. As a result of capitalism and its process of primitive accumulation, our life activity and labor has been divorced from the very conditions of this activity. So we have Marx's concept of alienation here, as you can see. The continuing effects of primitive accumulation and its forcing of people into a market over which they have no control, and which they ought not control, according to Hayek, and yet which nonetheless unleashes its effects upon them, has led to the main thesis of Robert's book on Marx, whereby Marx is to be read, quote, as radicalizing the Republican tradition for which freedom as non-domination is the highest virtue of institutions, end quote. What is key here is what Ellen Wood has claimed are the, Ellen Wood has claimed are the specific ways in which the market operates in capitalism. It's specific laws of motion that uniquely compel people to enter the market, to reinvest surpluses, and to produce efficiently by improving labor productivity. The laws of competition, profit maximization, and capital accumulation. These, so that's in her book, The Origin of Capitalism. It's a great book. These laws, on Wood's account, are solutions, kind of bringing us back to the nature of problems again. These laws, and I put laws here in scare quotes, right? Because that's one way of kind of disguising the fact of the contingency of these social relations that is basically Wood's point, that capitalism emerges as a solution to an agricultural problem unique to England in the late 16th century. But that solution has become seen as a law, almost a divinely ordained law, which is one of the reasons why you'll see the Christian right and neoliberal capitalists so closely aligned at the hip, at least in the United States. I don't know if that's true here, but in the United States, that's certainly true. So law becomes a kind of impersonality that simply dictates how things will go when it's really a solution to a problem. And I think that's where the sort of the Deleuzian notion here comes in. And a book like Wood's book kind of looks at the history where that solution emerged, where these laws emerged. As these solutions come to be seen as laws, they become, to state it in my terms, be seen as solutions without a problem, a determinate, inexorable process that predetermines in advance how things should go. This is not how problematic fields are to be understood. As I have been arguing, problems are inseparable from their solutions. There's no solution without a problem. And as such, determinate solutions are always solutions inseparable from a problem. And through historical inquiry and analysis, we may problematize these solutions or challenge narratives, beliefs, and practices which serve to hide or mask the problematic nature of things or our relationships with others and so on. In the case of capitalist society, for instance, one way to problematize practices and beliefs is to ask whether we are confusing being forced with being free. When one questions or problematizes the liberty that has come to be identified with the processes of capitalist markets, then perhaps the problematic nature that has not been exhausted by the solution may well create possibilities for transformations, for an undermining of the capitalist laws of motion. Now, one need not begin this process of questioning with grand institutional and economic structures. One can and should begin where one is, with the simplest of interactions, and through a process of critical analysis, problematize one's relationships to oneself, to others, and the world. This is the approach I claim Deleuze and Hume have tasked us with undertaking. This gets to the sort of the Deleuze-Humean political theory as I kind of sketching it out here. If our inquiries and critical analyses are to have, as Hume argues, quote, a direct reference to action and society, end quote, then we should begin with the expectations and habits that are ready to hand and inquire into the nature and conditions of these beliefs and behaviors, habits and expectations. Are they legitimate or illegitimate, justified or arbitrary? In a similar manner for Deleuze as well, including in his work with Guattari, we take the situation we find ourselves in and employ what they call, in what is philosophy, quote, a higher taste for problems, end quote. And the word taste is in English there, and I think it's a very direct reference to Hume and Hume's notion of taste, because just as with Hume's essay on the standard of taste, taste is not something that follows a determinate rule. There's no rule that one has when one has good taste that you can plug in and say, this poet's good, this one's not. And yet, there is a legitimate standard of taste whereby some people do have better taste than others. And I think there's a comparison here between this higher taste for problems, because there's no determinate rule that tells you this is the problem, because you can't identify a problem except in the solutions. But this taste is one way of revealing the problems inseparable from the solutions. Okay. Not every solution is something that you should be problematizing. Maybe you shouldn't be up in the middle of the night wondering whether 2 plus 2 is 4. Okay? Right? It's not like every determinate thing needs to be problematized and so on and so forth. Now, maybe in the right circumstances, kind of taking Quine's notion of the web of belief, right? Under certain radical situations, maybe some of our beliefs may be problematized, but Quine would take us too far afield at this point. And it's, let's see here. So a higher taste for problems for the conditions that made this situation possible, problematic reality, but may well transform it and give rise to something new. Since a problematic field is inseparable from its solutions, a higher taste for the nature of problems will have a feel for the problems that are inseparable from their solutions. So we can here see the difference between a Bourdieuian conception of a feel for the game. The feel is a feel for the determinate roles and behaviors that mark distinction in the social field. Whereas for Deleuze, the notion of feel would be a feel for the problematic, which isn't a feel for something determinate or actual, but it's a feel for the very conditions that may transform what has already been actualized. And this in turn may have the effect of problematizing solutions that are forced solutions. That is, solutions that are forced upon us as solutions without a problem, as the laws of capitalist motion have generally been given to us. It's a solution without a problem. That's the way things are. As Deleuze makes clear, however, that which is forced upon us can be very close to home. And this gets to the last quote. I've always liked this quote, but I've never been able to use it in a talk until today. So, the sorriest couples are those where the woman can't be preoccupied or tired without the man saying, "What's wrong? Say something." Or the man without the woman saying, and so on, right? Radio and television have spread this spirit everywhere, and we're riddled with pointless talk, insane quantities of words and images. Stupidity is never blind or mute, so it's not a problem of getting people to express themselves, but of providing little gaps of solitude and silence in which they might eventually find something to say. Repressive forces don't stop people expressing themselves, but rather force them to express themselves. What a relief to have nothing to say, the right to say nothing, because only then is there a chance of framing the rare and ever rare thing that might be worth saying. So think through that quote, what I was talking about earlier in terms of force versus free, right? If we think of forced to speak, forced to express oneself, if we take that forced nature as being how things should be, right? An example, and I'll be guilty, if my wife is quiet, I will say, "What's wrong? What's going on?" And it annoys her too, so I shouldn't do it, because I'll still... And likewise, and so there is a sense in which social interactions and so on and so forth will often force us or reproduce these very types of behaviors. And so I think the point here is that we should begin to question or even problematize some of these most inane of interactions that we have with our partners. Deleuze will offer a similarly mundane example in his postscript on control societies, when he notes that, quote, "If the stupidest TV game shows are so successful, it's because they're a perfect reflection of the way businesses are run. That is, businesses are constantly introducing an inexorable rivalry presented as healthy competition, a wonderful motivation that sets individuals against one another and sets itself up in each of them, dividing each within himself." So in other words, game shows kind of make fun or natural the very types of behaviors and et cetera, and desires that one would come to have that support the forms and institutions of power that currently exist. So game shows take the rivalry between businesses, the compulsion and necessity to compete on the market that comes with the capitalist laws of motion, and presents them as fun, as something we ought to take up, not only in our relations with others, but even with ourselves. We take on this division within ourselves, for example, with the rivalry between our current self and the self that seeks improvement, the better self that will be the result of, quote, "continual education and continuous assessment," end quote. Deleuze closes this essay, however, with an important question,
and one that gets to the heart of his problematizing approach, noting that, quote, many young people have a strange craving to be motivated. They're always asking for special courses and continuing education. But, he adds, it's their job to discover whose ends, expectations, it's their job to discover whose ends they are serving. So I end up with that. So in other words, whose ends are they serving by doing what they're doing? So for instance, what he's alluding to here is in the sort of Foucauldian sense, the basic institutions of disciplinary society, right? Factories, institutions, schools. It took the parents' generation a long time of difficult questioning to realize that they weren't serving their own interests. That's where strikes came in. That's why we have a strike going on now, and so on. And strike action became one of the ways of trying to get the interests that were not being seen to challenge that. Now what he's arguing is that we have a similar situation going on now with the contemporary control society, that this desire to, I don't know, watch game shows or continual improvement, continuing education, and so on, the motivation we seek motivational speakers and so on and so forth. We might get addicted to, if you go to a bookstore, you'll find many more books on self-improvement than philosophy. And so the question is this self-improvement really benefiting ourselves? Whose interests is that? So for instance, why do I ask my wife what's wrong? Or ask her to tell me what is on her mind if she is more quiet than usual? My routine, habitual answer is that I care for her and want to know if there's anything wrong so that I can help if I can. But if one continues to push this questioning, however, one may get to the point where one's reasons no longer make sense of one's situation and one is left not knowing what one should do. One will have problematized their situation. It is then that the taste or feel for problems enters the scene and may give rise to alternative solutions, to alternative ways of caring that may better serve the reasons we once thought made sense. In an echo of Marx, the point for Deleuze in developing a higher taste for problems is not that we will come to a better understanding of the states of affairs we find ourselves in, but we may make it possible to change them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.